Talking, Sunday, 18th January, 1981. Karma is misrepresented as retributive justice. It is also inadequately represented as equilibration, producing a balance, like Newton's third law of motion. Action and reaction are equal and opposite, which holds good, of course, where mechanics and mathematics are concerned, and mechanics deals with what happens on the macroscopic scale, not on the subatomic scale. So on the macroscopic scale, Newton's third law holds good, but otherwise these things don't hold good. And it is regarded as a rigid law of causation. This, of course, is the specifically Buddhistic presentation. The Buddha's presentation was a presentation which was by no means false, but it has been so misunderstood by the conditioned brain of people who have accepted the teaching that it is wise to look into it carefully. Now, there is a grain of truth in all these misrepresentations. The grain of truth is just this, that there is a relationship between an action or an event now and a subsequent action or event derived from this one at a later date. There is a relationship. But apart from that, one cannot say anything very definite. The Buddha's terminology was very simple. That being, meaning that those conditions prevailing, this becomes. Those conditions, those prevailing conditions become this. And of course it is conceived of as a chain of cause and effect. Now when you talk of a chain of cause and effect, just see what your brain does. It immediately thinks in terms of the links which make up a chain, doesn't it? It raises up all these pictures which bedevil the true conceiving of the thing. It is not a chain. This becomes, that is to say, that grows into this. The Buddha's teaching was a living teaching. It was an integrated presentation, not a mechanical presentation, not a synthesized presentation. Now, let us take a concrete example. And this, of course, is an example taken from the life of all humanity since humanity came on the scene. Man and wife conjugate on the 1st of January. On the following 7th of October, 280 days later, a baby arrives. Now, people who believe in karma inquire sometimes, so whose karma was it? The man's karma, or the woman's karma, or the baby's karma? Some say all three, some say this, and some say that. But let us look carefully whether that is a correct statement. Between the 1st of January and the subsequent 7th of October, 20,000 different factors, influences, persons, events have interplayed with this particular event which took place. That is to say, the fetus in the womb bears the impress of hundreds of thousands of impressions which come to it and upon it in various ways. Now, if we consider that very carefully and understand what its significance is, we will cease to say whose karma was it, my karma, your karma, or whatever it is. That's the wrong question. It's the wrong way to look at it. We will see that karma is a living process. It is a very involved process of unimaginable and therefore also immeasurable complexity. You see, just get the feel of these things as I say them. It is a tremendously complex process. Even as what we call a small thing, a small event, has a great deal of complexity involved in the little happening. So now, in this case, of course, the complexity is very, very great indeed. After all, just think, one fertilized ovum becomes, in course of time, after the birth of the child, 15 billion cells composing the body. One cell has become all this. Isn't it extraordinary? Isn't it complex? So now, if you feel and conceive of karma as an extremely involved process of unimaginable complexity, you will see that it is karma which has me or which has you, not I or you who have a karma. You see, karma is the total living process of the entire universe. That is the meaning of karma. In its transcendental depth, karma, derived from the root kri, means creative activity. It is the creative activity of the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, which in its aspect of mind releases cosmos out of chaos. This is what we must really begin to grasp. And that is totally immeasurable, ungraspable, because its context is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Whereas all the manifestations which come out as a consequence of the emergence of the cosmos are finite, temporal, and mortal. So you see, there are these two contexts. They are not two separate contexts. The context of the finite and the mortal is completely subsumed within the context of the infinite and immortal. Now you see, when one begins to see something like this, and not merely see with the brain, with the logical brain, because then it remains, if you see it only that way, it remains just as a string of words, so many thoughts and ideas. But if you can really thrill to it, respond to it, be in tune with it, then your very consciousness is awakening to this transcendent reality. And then, when consciousness awakens to the transcendent reality, your whole life completely changes. Your every thought and feeling, your word and your action bears the impress of that consciousness. That consciousness naturally expresses itself. You find that you'll be free of any struggle between virtue and vice then. Because if you have the real sense of transcendence functioning in you, you live as transcendence lives, as God lives, so to say. That is why in my first book, in the chapter on God conception, I put the idea that religion is the way in which God lives his life. I mean, one gets a completely different stance towards all existence. One ceases to be the slave of the idea of myself, here is the self, and all the rest of the universe is the not-self. But that is how we are conscious in the normal way. Every one of us is like that. It is simply because 4,000 millions on the globe are conscious in that way that the globe today is in this awful mess. If out of those 4,000 million, even 4 million could be conscious, not in terms of myself and the not self, but as one great total reality, which is the supreme whole, then we would all live and function in a totally different way. And that different way would be the true human way, which would also mean the true divine way, because the word human means the divine. So now, let us move on. Karma is therefore not a simple 1 plus 1 equals 2 affair. It is very complex. And let us now look at this phrase, retributive justice. Karma is retributive justice. Now consider how this idea came into being, at least in the European and American world. Our civilization is built upon Greek thought and philosophy and religion and teaching, and that of Jesus Christ. Our whole civilization is based upon that, you see. Now, in Greek mythology, Nemesis was the goddess of retributive justice. You know, in Greek mythology, there are profound things, but some of those things you have to beware of because they produce misconceptions. Now, retributive justice. You do wrong, Nemesis will catch up with you and punish you. So retribution and punishment go together. They are practically the same thing. And we must remember that this is not something conducive to growth. Retribution or punishment is of the nature of vengeance. Retribution. You think of it carefully. It is of the nature of vengeance, essentially. And it is associated with cruelty, the deliberate infliction of pain, the irate parent or schoolmaster soundly thrashing the naughty boy or whatever it is, and so forth. It is rooted in hate, in fear, violence, and unskill in action. Now, I particularly mention unskill in action because so many of you are interested in or actually practice yoga. And you remember how Sri Krishna in the Gita says to Arjuna, Arjuna, yoga is skill in action. Now, when Krishna was speaking to Arjuna, he was speaking as the incarnate Lord of the universe. The Hindus believe Krishna was the incarnate, was God incarnate, not just a son of God or an avatar merely, but God himself incarnate as such. These are all pleasant symbolical ways of looking at the thing. I don't take them literally, but there is deep meaning if one tries to go into it. Now, the Lord of the universe talks of action. Does he mean washing up after meals or this, that or the other? He said, if I did not perpetually engage in action, this, all the worlds would fall into ruin. Now, what sort of action does God incarnate indulge in? Surely, creative action which produces, maintains, and finally reabsorbs the entire cosmos, including us. That's the sort of action in which Sri Krishna engages. Now, he said, skill in action, and he said that to Arjuna, obviously, in order to help Arjuna to see that that is the kind of action which Arjuna should also perform. You see, creative activity. And that requires skill. Now, what creative activity do we indulge in which requires that kind of transcendental skill? Certainly, it is not manifest in punishment, in inflicting pain, in fear, hate, vengeance, and so forth. So, we see at once that retribution does not conduce to progressive change, to growth, therefore, which culminates in true flowering or fulfillment. It belongs to and confines us to the context of finitude, of sorrow, of decay, of death, of bondage and evil. That is what punishment, retribution, any cruelty, any harshness does. Retribution, above all, does not heal. Now, karma, as a creative activity, is a healing activity. We see that healing activity manifest in our own bodies. All the cells of our body, every one of them, has certain outstanding characteristics: self-motivation, self-reproduction, and self-healing, whole-making, holy-making. Even the physical body itself has this. And we human beings do not learn the lesson from it. So, retribution does not heal. It is not, therefore, creative action, whereas karma is creative action. Justice heals. So now, justice, obviously, therefore, cannot have any relationship to punishment or retribution. Justice heals, for it holds within itself mercy and compassion, patience, forbearance, understanding, and wisdom. And you will notice that all these things, all these qualities, are qualities which in their apotheosis are attributed to the Supreme, to the Divine itself. Take Judaism, for example. Our God is a zealous God, not jealous. This is a unfortunate translation. Our God is not a jealous, but a zealous God, one who is intensely concerned for our fruition and welfare. You see, our God is a zealous God, a God of mercy and compassion. That comes out again and again in the Old Testament. You see, but the Mosaic law, does indeed talk of a tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye, and all that sort of thing. The people of the times were such that was perhaps the only way in which Moses could put it to them under the circumstances. Now, justice is rooted in the infinite and immortal, not in the finite and mortal, because these qualities are transcendental qualities which belong to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And again, justice, in arriving at its judgments, is sensitive to many of the elements which compose the karmic process, and it has a vision of the relationship of these elements to the creative activity of karma. That means that when justice, true justice, is meted out, it so acts with the elements which compose the creative elements which compose the karmic process, that they enable you, the individual, to come to your flowering, to understand, to be able to dissolve the ill pattern of the psyche which produced the wrong state or wrong action, and recirculate that energy purified into good action, into right action, right living. You see? Now, this is a power which persuasively moves all things towards their true fulfillment. Thus we see that retributive justice is a self-contradictory phrase, quite misrepresenting karma. This we can tie up with another point, another very important point. People have presented karma as working through the course of so many lives. You are born again and again in order to work out your karma. And they also think in terms of retributive justice with karma. Now, you know, if retribution, punishment functioned fully all the time, all the way, there'll never be an end to the whole process. Because when you hurt somebody as punishment, in his subconscious there is stored up a revenge reaction. And when the circumstance is ripe, it bursts out again as some evil action. The cycle of evil will never end that way. It can only end by something which heals, which makes whole. And this idea, therefore, that you work out your karma life after life is utterly nonsensical. You don't do anything of the sort. Karma is a total and a universal process. We are like the leaves of a tree. Each one of us. We are like the leaves of a tree. Or even if you like the individual cells which make up a tree. The tree is mankind. The whole of mankind. The tree in actual fact is the total universe. And in the process, the karmic process of the creative activity process of the whole universe, all the different manifestations which come out are existential only. They belong to the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. And when they have gone through that cycle of finitude, temporality, and mortality, that is the complete end of that particular manifestation. Now do note, when I say end, there is no annihilation of it. Then you might say, but then where does it continue? It doesn't continue anywhere. In the complete end of the existential, the whole of that existential has become reabsorbed into the one and only non-being. That's why Sri Krishna said to Arjuna, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. Meditate over that for the coming year. It'll make a very big difference to your whole understanding of things. Being and non-being am I. And what applies to the words of Krishna, to Arjuna, applies to every one of us. You and I, every one of us, we are being and non-being. But beings are innumerable. They are special manifestations as such. Existential beings we are, you see. But when this existential being has performed its task, and as we say, the psychophysical organism dies, then it is gone completely into the one and only non-being. And in that going, there is no identifiable identity left, absolutely none. You don't carry a label with you into another limb, another realm, or a passport with your name and photograph and so forth. You just don't do anything of the sort. You are gone back into the absolute all. And in the going back into the absolute all, in that absolute allness, there is no possibility whatsoever of separate identifiable entity. I'm sorry if this upsets people, but I have seen this quite clearly, and I have to say what I have seen. Don't believe what I say, please. Examine it, consider it. Don't reject it out of hand. But just let it lie quietly in the mind. Not collecting dust, but just let it be alive and see what happens and what emerges. And see the sort of freedom, the freedom of the spirit and the freedom of the intellect which will be yours. When you really see the whole thing. See, the whole doctrine of reincarnation is tied up with the doctrine of karma. So if you understand karma as the total universal process in which, and this is how it happens, then you will get free of all these misconceptions. and your everyday life therefore will change. Look at the harm done to India. I mention India particularly because of their childish belief, I was born many times before, I shall be born again and again. Oh, well, there are many lives to work it out. The apathy and the utter futility of their effort and so forth. And they say, oh, it's my karma, what can I do about it? I've just got to endure it. That is all nonsensical. And then the other people, the so-called active people who are up and doing, make the mistake of fighting against, of trying to overcome their karma. You overcome nothing. Fighting merely means conflict and trouble and misery. You don't overcome anything. What you can do is to transform what is. There is no such thing as overcoming in the sense of completely getting rid of. Where will you throw anything out of the cosmos? Throw it from here to there, it's still in the cosmos. Dispatch it to the moon or dispatch it to Sirius or to a galaxy 2,000 million light years away. It is still there. You can't throw it out. You can transform it here and now. That is your task, your duty, your business as real human beings who are truly concerned with living the religious life. Do it now. Now, when you're alive, when you're conscious of it, this is your opportunity. And if you take your opportunity and do the right thing now, then when the existential being which goes by your name is dead, as we call it, you will have contributed to God godliness. God will once again realize God as man perfected and holy, and not as the impediment to divinity. Now, the great teachers, the perfected holy ones, knew all this kind of thing about karma and so forth very well indeed. They knew it only too well. Therefore, see what they taught in connection with our dealings with other people. Because the whole question of karma and justice is involved in our dealings with other people. In the Gospel of St. Matthew, the 5th chapter, the Sermon on the Mount, starting at, I'll read just a little section, verse 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. One of the profoundest teachings ever given. But consider how many of the thousands of millions of people who have been members of Christendom the last 2,000 years, how many of them have ever even begun to understand the significance of this? It's tremendous. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if a man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Why not? Perhaps on the second mile, you might be able to make him see a different view of things. Something which will put him into relationship with divinity if you went that other mile. Has that ever struck anybody? And whosoever give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. This was the common belief amongst the Jews of that age. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Now, how do you pray for them? Just mumble a set ritual of words? How do you pray for the other person? This is where the Buddha, 5 centuries earlier, gave a wonderful teaching in terms of the Brahma Viharas. And the practice of the Brahma Vihara, if one is capable of carrying it out in the right way, is the real praying, the real contemplative prayer. The contemplative prayer which releases energies from a transcendental depth and affects healing. And that is the meaning of praying for them. Otherwise, I mean, anybody can mumble so many words and nothing happens. And he says, do all this that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. And you know how St. Paul, in the epistle to the first epistle to the Corinthians, says, know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High? The psychophysical organism is the temple of the Most High. And in the Skanda and Maitreya Upanishads, it is stated openly, the body is, that is the existential being which is born and which will die, is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, who is the creator and the regenerator of the whole universe. Now let us see what the Buddha taught. In this discourse, which is the parable of the saw with which you cut wood, there are monks 5 ways of speaking in which others might speak to you. At a right time or a wrong time, according to fact or not according to fact, gently or harshly, on what is connected with the goal or what is not connected with the goal, with a mind of friendliness or full of hatred. And he teaches his monks, if people speak to you in any one of those ways, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech. But kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred, and we will dwell having suffused that person with a mind of friendliness. This is the praying, the getting into complete communion. It's easy enough to say, suffuse the other person with a mind of friendliness. But how do you do it? What happens actually? This is something very deep. We have spoken about this in 1 or 2 meetings a couple of years back, I think, but I can't remember when. But it's a very profound thing altogether. And beginning with him, we will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness, with a mind like the earth, far like the earth, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. That is how you should train yourselves, monks. That is, if somebody speaks harshly or evilly to you. And then he goes on towards the end of that discourse. Monks, even if low-down thieves might carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And beginning with him, we will dwell, having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. You will notice that not only does he say the positive thing, friendliness, but he also says, puts it in the negative form, without enmity, without malevolence. Because you know how we ourselves in our own everyday life, we sometimes feel full of friendliness and loving kindness and all that to this person or that person, and at other times we feel angry and we feel enmity. Now, as long as there is the possibility of enmity or malevolence or anger within the psyche, hidden within the psyche, it besmirches the sending out of the feeling of affection and friendliness and sympathy to the other person. That is why. If the psyche is completely clean, completely pure, then your friendliness and loving kindness and the good thoughts, as we call them, which you send out, have a chance of becoming operative. That is why the negative side has to be dealt with first. The negative is the more important side in spiritual progress and development and in living the religious life. Now, we have dealt with perhaps the most important part of this misconception of karma as retributive justice. You'll be interested, perhaps you already know this. You know what Aristotle said about justice? Justice is the practice of virtue towards others. Now, virtue, as you know, really is fundamentally creative power. This is virtue. The strength of the soul, the power of the soul, virtus. And Aristotle said, justice is the practice of virtue towards others. It comes in his Nicomachean Ethics, book 5, chapter 2. If you have a copy of the translation or if you read the original Greek, you'll find it there. Any Greek scholars here? I don't know any Greek myself. I only know these things from translation. Plato put it in another form, quite interesting and quite subtle, really. Plato said, justice is having and doing what is one's own. It sounds very worldly and nothing, we might expect something very wonderful from Plato. But a statement like that is having and doing what is one's own. It comes in the Republic, section 433. Each man, this is how it's developed, each man shall receive the equivalent of what he produces or gives and shall perform the function for which he is best fit. This is the state of justice. Put it in another form, a just man is a man in the right place, in his right place, doing his best, giving to society the full equivalent of what society gives him. I have only one quarrel with that presentation. I don't like the use of the word equivalent there. Equivalent introduces the idea of measurement. How shall I measure what you give me out of the fullness of your heart or whatever it is? Now, how absurd for me to try and measure out what I shall give you in return. This is just being a shopkeeper, isn't it? If you look at it that way. And yet, if you study the Republic, it's a tremendously long dialogue. It takes a year to read right through it, and understand it properly. If you study the Republic carefully, you will see that he's put in a very simple and a subtle form what he, the crux of what he wants to present. And the crux of it is this: justice is a taxis kai cosmos, an order and beauty, an effective harmony of the whole, of the totality. Now, this is the real thing. This is justice. An effective harmony of the whole. And this is the reality of karma. Karma is a completely just process. You see? And you see what justice means, therefore, really, when we look into all these things. So now, clearly, anything like rigid causation must be ruled out. Because rigid causation will imply the tit-for-tat attitude, which is just leads you nowhere. You can go on for all time without ever reaching any sort of fulfillment or realization. There's no growth that way. And if we rule out rigid causation, but understand the relationship of one thing with the next thing, any one thing as a cause grows out of that state into the next state, which is the effect. And it is that growing out into the effect which is the real rationale of the karmic process. It is a growing out of the state of being a cause and influence and becoming the effect, which in its turn becomes the cause of the next next state, which is the next effect. And so the whole living, growing process of the universe goes on that way. Now this makes far more sense of the whole thing. This is the sort of thing that the Buddha actually did teach, this, the cause growing out of its state and becoming the next state. And this is one of the reasons why he presented that tremendous teaching of changeless, of change. Everything changes. There is nothing which stays put, which is changeless. You see, anicca. Anicca really had better be translated not as impermanent, because that makes you think of, oh well, it's gone, it's dying, it's annihilated or something. But think of it as the relative. Nitya or nitya is the eternal. Anicca is the relative. Now the relative undergoes all these transformations in time and space, and the creative activity in eternity is that which produces this whole panorama of events and so forth, which is the universal process. If you really sort of get the feel of it once into the inner depth of your mind, you will experience an extraordinary delight, and you'll know what it is to be a part of a living, creative universe, divine in essence and in nature. So now, if we can perceive the true nature, more or less perceive, because one's little brain cannot perceive too much at any one time, one has to grow and grow, more or less of karma, we can direct the course of our life intelligently and humanly. Humanly. We can cease, which means that we can cease to be producers of evil and swim contrary to the stream of suffering engulfing all that lives. But in this swimming contrary to the stream of evil does not imply that we are resisting the evil or fighting it. We utilize the evil that there is in the whole world as a challenge to us, so to function, so to live, that we can be in harmony with the total, with the totality of existence. An effective harmony of the whole, if you like, as Plato put it. You see? So that you live in the world, but you are not of the world. The Buddha said outright that he neither agrees nor disagrees with whatsoever anybody says. He just listens. He just listens and takes note and understands the truth of the matter. And when one has arrived at that stage where one can, through the purification of one's daily life, the complete purification of the psyche, do this kind of thing, then we are truly, if you like to use the old-fashioned phrase, we are truly the sons of God. And daughters too.